Blog Talk Radio.
Start the clock. Good afternoon. At the tone, time will be real
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Let's Change the World Movement Talk Radio Show. I've got a cold today, so you'll have to bear with me, but the Let's Change the World Talk Radio Show is a product of the Let's Change the World Movement, and the movement is all about everybody doing whatever little bit we can, no matter how small it is, to positively impact somebody else's life other than your own, or to positively impact your community as a whole. And it's all about just basically getting off your dead ass and doing something. Get involved in your community, make something happen. No matter how small it is, you are making a difference. To learn more about the movement, visit the Change the World blog at www.thechangetheworldmovement.com. That's www.thechangetheworldmovement.com. And learn more about the movement and how you can make a difference in not only your community, but the world. It's kind of like a domino effect. You push one domino over and the rest start falling. It's kind of like throwing a pebble in a big giant pool of water. It's a tiny pebble, but when you throw it in the water, the ripples ripple all the way across the pool. So every random act of kindness makes a difference that can travel around the world. So that's what the Let's Change the World movement is all about. And my co-host is going to be here. I'm still waiting on her to join in with us. Come on, Cheryl, where are you? Oh, there you go. Cheryl Elisa has been with me for so long, and she's so wonderful. I haven't talked to her in a while because I've been sick. She's been busy, had some personal issues. Cheryl, are you there, baby?
Dale, where are you at? I'm here.
Okay, we got so many people on the phone lines, I had to go down and down and down and down find you.
That's okay. I'm here. Hi, everybody. Good evening. Yeah, you in that
hey,
cold.
Oh, my God. I feel better just hearing your voice, of course.
I knew that was going to help you. Of course. I am the medicine. I'm your remedy. I'm your radio wife. It's good to hear
Absolutely.
You, though. I'm glad that you're feeling better. You sound better than earlier when I spoke with you.
Well, I've been trying to take it easy, you know what I mean? I knew this was going to be a big show, and I could tell by the phone lines it really is going to be a big show.
Yes.
And then the show is all about today. We're going to skip over all the normal stuff. We normally do our books and music that change the world segment. We normally do our ridiculous news. But I didn't want to spare one single moment without getting right into the show today. And, you know, a lot of people are innocent until proven guilty. It's been there's been so much going on this week. I don't want to go into the show before we talk about this just real quick. This week, there have been several deaths due to police violence. Some would call it police brutality and violence and murder. Then in retaliation, there have been cops murdered. And I just want to say real quick, this show is somewhat relevant because I believe that many of the problems that we're having right now with the police brutality and the violence and the retaliation stems from something that I call mass incarceration, which stems from just a lack of common sense, morals, values, and ethics in our nation these days. Okay. We just have to do the right thing by everyone. A lot of people feel that race is at the core of this issue. I believe race is a part of it. I believe that it's a lot more complex than that, though, based on our unlimited education research. I believe that racism in itself stems from other complex issues involving morals, values, and ethics. So it's a very complex problem, but it's not going to get solved by division. It's not going to get solved by violence. I'm a Christian. I believe if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. If we think that we are going to make a difference by killing police officers, the people who we charge to protect and serve us, that's not going to work. Okay, it's just going to escalate more violence, and the police are going to be more trigger happy than ever. They're going to be arresting more people, fueling more mass incarceration, and it's just not going to end good. In our society today, we need more love, we need more unity, and that's what's going to solve this problem.
I agree. It is a lot going on. In all actuality, it has been going on for a while. I think now, the way that we're living now, cameras play a big part, because back in the day, you know, cameras weren't available. But I totally agree with I agree that all lives matter. It's nothing even about race. You do. You have to love each other and get along. You know, it's coming to the point where everyone is going against each other, and it shouldn't be like that. It's a division, and it should not be like that. I actually want to say this real quick. I'm praying for all families, from the victims to the police officers to, you know, just anybody that has encountered things that's going on like this, you know, and it does need to stop. And, you know, I hopefully in the future everyone will see what's going on and start coming together instead of being apart.
Exactly. And part of coming together is about standing up for those who have suffered injustice. You know, there are a lot of people out here, and when I say a lot of people, I'm talking about thousands of people. The Ohio State University did a study. Ohio State University is a very reputable college, Big Ten college, and they did a study, and they believe that based on the results of that study, that there might be as many as 10,000 people wrongfully convicted right now sitting in prison. So even if that is, some people feel that's a conservative estimate, some people feel that that's an outlandish estimate, but even if it is an outlandish estimate, even 2,000 would be way too many. Even 10 would be way too many. I would argue that one is way too many. And it doesn't seem like a big deal if it's not somebody in your family or if it's not you.
Right.
But, you know, you never know what's going to happen in life. You can be at the wrong place at the wrong time and something happened and someone points a finger at you. And now you're the accused, and you get tried, you get convicted, you get railroaded, they mishandle the evidence, witnesses change their statements, and the prosecutor wants to make a career for himself, and all of a sudden you're sitting in prison, and your family, your friends, and even your children are now looking at you as a murderer.
Right.
Imagine how that feels. And then people start to forsake you. All the people who used to be your friends and everything, they start to, even your family, they start to forsake you. Even the couple family members who might want to visit you, they still in the back of their mind, or maybe in the back of your mind, you find it hard to believe that they believe that you are innocent because you were convicted
exactly.
by a jury. That's got to be
yeah,
a living hell.
Thought.
Yeah.
Right.
And
just
now
you're trying to prove this point that you are innocent.
Exactly. And now you're sitting in prison for years and years. Your life is passing you by. Your kids are growing up. Your wife might leave you and go get another man or whatever. Or if you're a woman, your husband might leave you. And now you're looking for complete strangers, don't know you, who don't have anything to do with you or nothing invested in you, to simply come on your team, you know what I mean, and say, I believe in you and I'm going to try to help you. Because when you're locked up, I don't know how many people out there have never been locked up. There's nothing you can do. You can't do anything for yourself. You know what I mean? The only thing that can be done from you for you has to be done by somebody who's on the outside. But you have to count on complete strangers now to believe in you and help you out. Now, today you're going to hear the story of one man who's going through this right now, you know. And we're going to hear this story, and I'm going to bring on a gentleman who knows the story inside and out, backwards and forward. He's been there since the beginning. He's an investigator. His name is Dave Beers. Mr. Dave Beers is with us today, and I'm going to bring him on right now. Let me see if I see you. There you go. Mr. Beers, are you there?
I'm here.
How you doing?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good. We're glad to have you here today. What is the gentleman's name we're talking about?
His name is Peter Walasik.
How do you spell that?
It's the last name is Walasik. It's W-L-A-S-I-U-K.
And tell us a little about Mr. Walasik before any of this ever happened. What kind of a man was he, as far as you know, of course, before any of this ever happened?
He was a pretty hardworking businessman. He was an over-the-road truck driver for a period of time. And then he bought a bar in the area where he lived, and he worked at that to make a living for himself and his wife Patty. So he's just a hardworking man. His family, his father lived in the area with him, and his mother at the time. She's deceased now, but just kind of a hardworking truck driver and businessman.
And what community are we talking about?
We're talking about a little rural town in upstate New York in Shenango County. It's a rural county, sparsely populated, mostly agricultural. The county seat is a place called Norwich, New York. And this particular case involving Peter occurred in the town of Guilford, which is just a few minutes away from Norwich.
And what happened one day?
It's a long story, but what happened was back in April of 2002, April 2nd, Peter picks up his, he gets his wife and his three young daughters, and he takes them down to an adult babysitter right down in the hamlet of Guilford. Her name was Joyce Warden. And she'd been babysitting for the children for several months before this happened. And he drops off Patty and the children, and then he goes on to work at his bar, which was called the Angel Inn, right there in Guilford. Patty borrowed Joyce's car that afternoon to go to work. She had done that in the past, and so it wasn't unusual. But on this particular day, the reason she borrowed Joyce's car was because the inspection had expired, and Peter was going to have it inspected the next day for her. So Patty takes Joyce's car and goes to work. She worked as a nurse in the emergency room at the local hospital in Sydney, New York, which was about 15 minutes away. And she worked the 3 to 11 shift.
Okay.
So she goes to work, takes Patty's car. Then we kind of fast forward to about 10:30. And Joyce's son comes home. And he tells
his
mother he got
10:30 in the morning or 10:30 in the evening?
This is 10:30 on the night of April 2nd.
At night.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to clarify for everybody. We're talking about nighttime now, right?
Yes, correct. It's dark. It's nighttime. It's cold out. And her son comes home and tells his mother that he just got a ticket for no headlight. And Joyce was a little concerned because Patty had her car and the inspection was overdue. So she calls her at the hospital to caution her to be careful coming home. And the original plan was for Patty to pick up the children on her way home at Joyce's house. It's right on the way. You have to go right by Joyce's house to get back to Patty's house. So she would normally pick up the kids around 11:30 because she gets out between 11 and 11:15. About 11:40, Patty hadn't showed up yet, so Joyce called Peter. Now, Peter had gone home early from the bar because it was a Tuesday night. Things were slow. Him and a coworker had to take one of the customers home because she'd had too much to drink. And then Peter went home in the 10:30 time frame and just relaxed and was waiting for Patty and the kids to get home. Around 11:40, Joyce called Peter and wanted to know where Patty was because she hadn't stopped to pick up the kids yet. And Peter basically just said, you know, she's probably running a few minutes late. Give her a few minutes. So she hung up, and now we fast forward to about 12:15. Peter gets another call from Joyce. Patty's not here yet. What do you want me to do? And he says, well, let's give her about 5 more minutes. Okay, so about 2 minutes later, Patty pulls in the driveway at Peter's house, comes in the house. She doesn't have the children. An argument ensues, and Peter calls Joyce to tell her that Patty just got home and that they would be right down to get the children. Later, Joyce would tell the police that she heard Patty and Peter arguing about coming to pick up the children, and her son, who was there at the time, also heard them arguing in the background. So as Peter's hanging up the phone with Joyce, Patty's running out the door, and for whatever reason, we're still not sure, she jumps into Peter's truck instead of Joyce's car. And Peter's trying to follow right behind her. He's quickly slipping on his boots. She's in the driver's seat, so he jumps in the passenger seat, and they start heading down the hill towards Guilford, arguing extensively over her not picking up the children. While they're on their route down there, it's about 3 miles down to the county road, the county route 35, and then just another couple of minutes to Joyce's house in Guilford. Patty lights up a cigarette on the way, and she rolls down her window partway. And as she pulls out onto County Route 35, which is the main road, a hot ash from the cigarette blows into the back of the truck. So she pulls over onto the shoulder of the road quickly, and both her and Peter kind of lean through the console to check on the hot ash. And that starts another argument, you know, about trying to burn my truck. And so the argument, it just is relentless. And then while she's checking on the ash, he smells beer on her breath. And that really pushes him over the edge because Patty was an alcoholic. She'd had a lengthy history of DWIs. And so it really upset him. And he said, you know, just turn the truck around and go home. We'll get the kids later. Patty was really upset. She didn't want to do that. But she pulls over, pulls back out into the road, pulls into a driveway on the opposite side to start to make a K-turn. And for whatever reason, the truck didn't get put in reverse. And she stepped on the gas, and it went down the embankment. About a 20-degree incline down to the lake, about 70 feet away, and the truck went right in the lake. At first, Peter was just saying to himself, you know, how the heck am I going to get out of here? But then he quickly realized that there was more involved, and water starts coming in. The truck is working its way out into the lake, partially staying afloat, but then it starts to sink. He tries to get out the passenger door, but it was locked. When the car is on and in gear, the doors lock automatically. But he looks across at Patty, and he sees the open window. And so he starts to crawl right over Patty because she's kind of frozen behind the wheel. And as he's going out the window, he reaches back and grabs her coat collar and drags her with him out the window. But then the force of the water or the coldness of the water or the weight of the water, it's really not sure. But he loses grip of Patty. Her coat comes off, and he loses her. So now it's just a matter of self-survival for him. The water is frigid. It's about 38 degrees. He's about 60 feet from shore. So he surfaces and tries to get oriented in the dark and finally sees a little bit of daylight or lighting toward the road. So he makes his way to shore. He's probably only in the water for 30 seconds to a minute. Then he climbs up on shore. Somewhere along the line, he lost his boots. He doesn't have a memory of where he lost them, someplace during the escape from the vehicle. Now, it's early spring. Most of the residences along the lake are seasonal, so there's nobody living there yet. So he's knocking on a couple of doors. Nobody's answering. He's hollering for Patty, screaming. He finally knocks on a door, and somebody answers. It was a young man and his girlfriend and another male friend who were staying there, and he asks them to call 911. He's standing there in his stocking feet, dripping wet, shivering profusely, and this young man, his name is Tom Becker, he calls 911, and you can actually hear Peter in the background in the first part of the conversation where he, just a real high-pitched voice, very excited, trying to explain what happened. Mr. Becker explains the situation, and they said that they would send someone. So he hangs up, and then him and Peter and his friend Stephen, Mr. Becker's friend Stephen, all get in a car and drive the short distance back to where the driveway was, where Patty was going to make the K-turn. They stop the car, get out, and they start looking around. And Peter is somewhat incoherent, appears to be in shock. So one of the guys tells him to go up on the road and to flag down the police when they get there. So he does that. In the meantime, these two guys start to go in the water, but it's extremely cold. And then Thomas Becker runs back home and gets a rowboat, aluminum rowboat, a dive suit, a wetsuit, and swim fins. And he comes back and puts the wetsuit on and the swim fins, and he goes out over the truck. You can actually see the truck in the water. It's completely submerged in about 12 feet of water. The lights are still on, so you can see the outline of the truck underwater. So he goes out in the water, and he goes down feet first and tries to get to the truck, and he just barely touches the roof of the truck, and he later would say that the water was so cold it was taking his breath away, so he had to get out. He gets out and runs home and jumps in the warm bathtub to warm himself up. In the meantime, first responders start showing up, the police, the firemen, and the EMTs, and a young trooper by the name of Jamie Bell was monitoring the radio calls, and he quickly called in and said, you know, I'm a diver, I have my equipment with me, do you want me to respond? And they said yes, and he was only a couple minutes away. So he responds, he gets there, other first responders help him suit up, He goes in the water. He's, you know, Peter had told them where he had lost Patty, so that was the area that he focused on. So he goes in the water. He's only in there about 2 minutes, and he finds Patty on the bottom of the lake. He puts her in a bear hug and brings her to the surface where first responders were waiting in that rowboat to take her into the boat. So they get her into the boat, and then they bring her into shore and bring her up on the dry land where they start resuscitation efforts. They were trying to insert a laryngoscope to open her airway, but they were not successful after several attempts. So they started manual CPR and breath impressions, and the EMTs spoke about water coming from her mouth and the smell of beer on her breath. They were unable to revive her, so they got her into the ambulance and did CPR all the way to the hospital. In the meantime, Peter was placed into the back seat of a patrol car, and the heat was cranked up all the way to warm him up. And then when the other ambulance got there, he was transferred from the patrol car into the ambulance, and they made him get out of his wet clothes and then started applying some warm packs and towels to warm him up. And a deputy was assigned to go into the ambulance with him. And one of the mistakes Peter made, and I understand why he did it at the time, but he was very concerned about Patty's drinking and the fact that she'd been drinking that night and did not want to see her arrested again. So he made up a story about Patty swerving to miss a deer, which wasn't true. And that's kind of haunted him ever since. But anyway, the ambulance with Patty goes to the hospital. The ambulance with Peter leaves. The ambulance with Peter stops at Joyce Warden's house, where Peter quickly checks on the children, and then Joyce digs up some dry clothes from her son to let Peter wear. So he changes into the dry clothes, gets back into the ambulance, and then on to the hospital. Joyce made arrangements to have somebody come and stay with the kids, and then she drove herself to the hospital with her friend's car. So now they're all at the hospital. Patty arrives, and the ER doctor examines her real quickly and pronounces her dead in less than 2 minutes. And it's probably around 1:20 a.m. if I recall the time correctly. And then Peter, in the meantime, is waiting in a different exam room. He doesn't know what Patty's status is. He's assuming that she's alive, she's been found, but he doesn't know that. And it was about 2:30 when the doctor came in to examine him, to check him for the possibility of hypothermia. And at that time, he's advised that Patty did not survive. And then shortly thereafter, the deputy who was there took a written statement from Peter about what had happened that night. So that's how it happened. There's a lot more to the story. Patty is transported to Lourdes Hospital in Binghamton, New York, which is about 40 minutes away, where they do an autopsy later that day. Dr. James Terzian did the autopsy, and two members of the Sheriff's Department witnessed it. You got a question?
Can I ask you a quick? Yes.
Sure.
So when he was in the ambulance with the deputy, he gave a story about a deer, dodging a deer. Now, 2:30 in the morning when the police took a statement, did he keep that same story, or did he change the story?
No, he kept the same story.
Okay.
Yeah, he had already told that same deputy in the ambulance that story, so he stuck to that story in his written statement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Patty's body.
They examined the body, and what did they find?
Initially, the doctor ruled it probable drowning pending toxicology. The only toxicology they did that came back positive was for alcohol, blood alcohol. And her blood alcohol, it was actually tested in two different venues. One of them, it was a 0.04, and the other one was a 0.05. So she was impaired but not legally intoxicated.
Okay.
But she had consumed alcohol sometime between getting out of work and when this happened. During the autopsy, the doctor notices some burdocks in her hair and stuck to her clothing. It's noted and photographed, but not collected. Her clothing is documented. All the articles that were in her pockets are inventoried and photographed and placed in evidence, just the way you're supposed to do it. Another unusual aspect of this case was the fact that before Peter left the hospital, it was standard protocol with a victim this young to ask family if they could collect harvest her organs. So Peter gave them consent to harvest her organs, but it had to be after the autopsy. So the organ and donation people were responding, and they took the body after the autopsy, and they did in fact harvest what organs were available to them. And then subsequently she was picked up by the funeral home to be prepared for her upcoming funeral. What else? Peter, when he leaves the hospital, he goes back to Joyce's house, and her son takes him up to his house to pick up Joyce's car and bring it back. And that was another unusual thing that we can talk about later. The police didn't appear to be interested in where Joyce's car was. But anyway, and then he goes over to the funeral home and starts making arrangements for the funeral. The police continue their investigation. They find some articles. Well, backing up a little bit, while they're at the scene, of course, it's in the dark, and they're taking some measurements and some photographs in the dark, but they're not the greatest because the lighting was poor, and they should have waited till daylight, but they didn't. And they decided to pull the truck out of the water even before daylight, which, I don't like to second guess, but it should have been left in place until daylight where they could take pictures underwater, and they didn't do that. So they made arrangements for that same trooper to go down and hook up a winch, and they winched the truck out probably around 5:30 in the morning. It was still dark. They pull the truck out, get it up on the road, put it on a flatbed, and haul it off to a local garage where they lock it up. And then the police later go there and inventory it and make a list of everything that was in the truck.
Let me ask you a question real quick. I want to ask you just a real quick question. And actually it's two, but the what I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, was the window partially down on the driver's side? Was it completely down or was it partially down?
Partially down. It was down a foot or better. They never actually measured it or put a ruler up next to it. In one of their testimonies they said it was 12 inches, and in an earlier testimony they said it was 18 inches.
Because you see what I'm doing with this. Okay, if it's partially down, I'm trying to, and you're underwater, just thinking, how could you get out of that window partially down and the car is submerged, the truck, excuse me, is submerged underwater? I mean, do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Maybe that was...
What I don't know... What I don't know is if Peter got out before the truck was totally submerged, or
okay.
someplace in between.
Okay.
But if you look at the window, it's certainly wide enough. The opening is certainly wide enough for somebody to get through. Peter,
okay.
Peter's not very big, and Patty's very petite herself, so it wouldn't have been a problem for them to
okay.
to go through the window.
Okay. Okay. And then another thing real quick.
Yeah.
Is that common for the ambulance to stop? Normally, you know, all of us knows, I guess, you know, when an ambulance arrives, they immediately take you straight to the hospital. How common is that for them to stop off to someone's house? You know what I mean? To get a change.
You know, I don't know how that came to be exactly. I don't know if it was an EMT's suggestion to get clothes, or if it was
okay.
Peter's request. I'm not sure, but it is a little unusual. But he was not in a life threatening situation, so they probably accommodated him.
Okay.
And in small towns,
sure.
things can be done differently than they are in bigger cities and things like that, where you have much more protocol.
I'm just asking because I agree with that. I'm just asking because some people, you know, would question that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I totally agree.
It's a good question.
Yeah, they. Yeah.
Well, I questioned it when I first saw it because I thought it was unusual as well. But like I said, his injuries were not life threatening, and they probably thought it was a good idea for him to get a dry set of clothes to put on.
Okay.
But it struck me unusual that they would take someone who had too much to drink home, because in small towns, I suppose that happens, but in cities. You know, they'll call you a cab, maybe. That's about the best you're going to get, or if you got a best friend. But for the owner of the bar to say, hey, but, you know, you've had too much to drink, I'm going to just do you a favor and take you home, that's very unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Peter had not been drinking.
Right.
Himself. But anyway, so what happens next? On April... 5th, the police apply for a search warrant for Peter's house, and they're asking to search for diaries and journals and ledgers or other writings that Patty may have made where there was evidence that she might have felt her life was in danger. And they also asked to take the pickup truck. They already had that in their possession, but they got a warrant so that they could make it official, which was the right thing to do. So they went to Peter's house on April 5th. Peter was not there. He was making arrangements for the funeral, and then he later met with one of the investigators at their station, but. There was a team who went there, and they found various writings, and they spent two or three hours there collecting and photographing and noting everything that they took. But the interesting thing about that was that one of the items that they took was not authorized by the search warrant. It was a burdock bush growing outside. Near the house, and the interesting thing about that is they did not photograph it or make a note of it like they did everything else. And when they left the property receipt at the house of the items that they took, claiming everything was accurate, they did not put that burdock bush on that list. And then when they did the search warrant return to the court, they have to let the court know what they took, what they seized. They failed to put that burdock bush on the return also. But interestingly, they did put it on their in-house evidence log. And that is an issue. but anyway, and then we kind of fast forward to April 7th. Now, I got to back up a little bit. When the state police diver went back in the water on April 3rd to hook up the truck, while he was down there, he found a brown coat off the driver's rear bumper area. And he picked it up to make sure that there wasn't another victim, but there was none, so he just left it there, which was pretty unusual, knowing that in a couple minutes you're going to be winching the truck right out over it. And also at that same time, he sees a flashlight, like a not a regular flashlight, but a handheld flashlight, one that you would use like a spotlight. And it was resting right on the bumper of the truck underwater. And he thought it was pretty unusual, so he picked it up and thought about it for a minute, and then he decided, you know, hey, I'll just put it in the back of the truck, and they'll figure it out later. So he did that. But why he didn't do that with a coat, I don't know. So he gets out of the water, and they winch the truck out. They get the truck partway out, and then they have to stop the process because the front wheels have turned sideways, so the vehicle is doing kind of a plowing effect. So they're having trouble. So they decide to stop the winch, and another tow truck operator who was assisting, he went down and he opened up the driver's door, and of course all the water rushes out, and anything that was inside floating around came out with it. So he goes in, he straightens up the wheel, and then they continue to winch the truck out of the lake.
Did the diver, did he admit to that? Did he admit to the flashlight and the spotlight and the coat and that he put it in back of the truck? Was that admitted in testimony?
Yeah, he talked about finding the light and putting it in the back of the truck, but he really didn't have an answer as to why he didn't put the coat in there as well. But he said he did tell a couple of deputies about it. But the odd thing about that, for whatever reason, they wait for 4 days. And on April 7th, a Sunday, they arrange a dive detail. And they bring in a new diver, and they send him down to examine the underwater scene and take some pictures. And while he's down there, he finds the coat. He brings it out. He took a photograph of it, and he brings it out and puts it on the shoreline. And he reaches in the pocket, and it's got her driver's license in the pocket, but nothing else, according to him. They also recovered a big toolbox on the bottom of the lake that had come out of Peter's truck, one of those big diamond plate toolboxes that goes in the back of a pickup truck. And they did absolutely nothing with it. They didn't even open it and inventory it or even take a picture of it. And I found that pretty odd. But anyway, they document the coat, they take pictures, they take it into evidence, and it subsequently gets sent up to the state police laboratory for a forensic exam.
Is this her coat?
Excuse me?
Was that her coat?
Yeah, that was her coat. It was
her
coat.
Yes, her driver's license was found in there.
According to their testimony, that was the only thing that was found in the pockets when it came out of the lake. Later, we would find out when it came back from the lab that there was a lot of other items in her coat. Money, keys, medical injectors, a variety of things. We have photographs of all that stuff, but they denied that it was. You know, they said they didn't bother looking through her pockets, which was pretty bizarre. And that became a. It's still a major issue.
Let's fast forward a little bit to the court case itself that got him convicted.
Yeah. I just to correct you a little bit, I was not involved from the very beginning.
Okay.
I was not involved before the first trial. I wasn't involved until the fall or early winter of 2007. So the first trial had already taken place in November of 2002, and then it was appealed, and he won the appeal, and it was sent back, and he was assigned a new attorney, and that's when I got involved.
You say he won the appeal?
He won the first appeal. Yes, that's why he was granted a new trial.
Okay, explain the logistics of how this works. So there was a first trial where he was convicted.
Correct.
And then they had another trial to see if he could, or there was an appeal to see if he could have another trial?
Correct. Yeah, there was an appeal because there were some issues that came up during the trial that were appealed, and the appellate division agreed with Peter and granted him a new trial. They threw out the conviction and granted him a new trial.
Was he released?
No. He remained in custody until the new trial, and then he was assigned a new attorney. The new attorney had to get up to speed on the case, and shortly after he reviewed the case, he got me involved. I had done some work for him in the past, so he called me and wanted me to take a look at the case, which I did, and I immediately saw all kinds of issues that needed to be looked into. But one of the biggest issues that I had regarding the first trial was the fact that Peter had consulted with an independent forensic pathologist by the name of Dr. Michael Sicarica from the Albany, New York area. And he concluded that it was, in fact, a drowning and not a smothering, like Dr. Terzian would later change his testimony or change his report. And Dr. Sicarica said that it had all the telltale signs of drowning. There was no reason to believe that it was anything other than a drowning. And he was willing to testify to that, but it was never called by the defense in the first trial.
Wow.
And that was troubling for me to find that out.
So,
that, you know, here you got somebody that you've already consulted with, willing to testify to it, someone who has more experience than Dr. Terzian had, and they never call him.
Okay, so I need to back up a little bit.
Sure.
Okay, so we've basically, it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, we've heard Peter's side of the story.
Yeah.
What is the prosecution's side of the story? What do they say had to have happened that got him convicted?
Sure. The prosecution theory is that Peter planned this whole thing out, and that on the night of April 2nd, he drove his white truck to the hospital and picked up Patty, took her home. They had something to eat. He forced her to drink beer. Then he took her out behind the house and suffocated her in a burdock bush out behind the family swimming pool, dragged her body to his truck, along with her coat, and threw him in the back of the truck, drives down to Guilford Lake, stops at the top of the bank, puts the truck in gear, closes the door, and lets the truck roll into the lake. And then he goes down and takes a dip in the lake and comes back out. That's their theory.
Well, what is the explanation of the burdock bush? From my understanding, the burdock bush, they were located in their backyard, but not in the area where she drowned?
Yeah, well, that's the whole issue. They're claiming that in their examination of the scene, they didn't find any burdocks. But it's clear to me that there were burdocks there. They just didn't find them.
Okay.
I've been up there many times since, and there's burdocks growing all over the place up there. Even right where the truck went in the water, they're growing there now. So I think they just looked around, didn't find any, so they just assumed that the burdocks got into her hair from an assault up at the house.
So that's the whole thing right there is the burdock.
Yeah, the burdocks is a key element here, very key element, and because they found burdocks in her hair, on her clothing, but there was also, it's interesting, there was also the state police diver had a burdock on his wetsuit, but yet the police say there aren't any burdocks anywhere near that area. They walked all around.
That got brought up in the case.
Yeah, we even consulted with a botanist from Cornell, and he examined the scene. Of course, this is after the fact, but he said burdocks are common in that area. They grow around bodies of water, and probably the most troubling thing was that. The police had consulted with a biologist from Binghamton University who came up and looked at the scene, but he never examined any of the foliage left behind from the impact of the truck. You can clearly see in the photographs that there's foliage broken and spread across the shoreline. And when he was shown a picture of that, he said, I don't remember seeing those there because... Even if the little burdocks themselves had gotten knocked off and drifted away in the lake, the branches were still there. So there was a means to determine whether there were burdocks there or not, and that was never done.
Mm-hmm.
And when a man's life is at stake, that should have been an important element to do. But
yes,
they just went up there and said, no, we don't see any of those little burdocks around, so it must be there aren't any. So
when did they look for him? Was that night?
Yeah. Well, yeah. They went back in the daytime and claimed they look around. But what they did was insufficient to be able to say conclusively that there's no burdocks there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the whole turning point for Dr. Terzian to change his findings from. Drowning to suffocation. No, he didn't find any medical reason. He would just go on to say that, no respectable woman would go pick up her children with burdocks in her hair. That might be true, but those burdocks could very well have come from the scene during the rescue attempt. If there were burdocks floating in the water and she's being rescued, that's a very reasonable explanation as to how they got into her hair or on her clothing.
Right.
Yeah, because if they're floating in the water and you pull your head up out of the water, they attach to your hair.
Sure. Yeah. No, nobody's thinking about burdocks during the rescue attempt. It's dark out, so they could be clinging to anything that gets in their way, and you're not going to be thinking about that at the time.
And the fact
you
that some was
on
the wetsuit.
The diver suit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and he mentioned that in his testimony. I thought, you know, the trooper was pretty credible, with the exception of leaving the coat in the lake. I found that a little troubling, but I think he was honest about, you know, he said that he had a burdock on his wetsuit. He didn't know where it came from.
Well, even the jacket supports his Peter's story. Because he said that the jacket came off. I mean, if he had just pushed her in the water, you know, the jacket would still be on her. How would it get off her and just float around?
Yeah, well, they claim that the coat may have come off during the assault, and he just threw the coat in the back of the truck with her.
But if you're trying to cover up a murder, you know, I'm sure the guy's no fool. He's a businessman. You're not going to leave a big piece of evidence like that laying around.
No, that's my point. You know, if he had planned this out and he wanted to stage it, he wouldn't have. First of all, he wouldn't have put her in the back of the truck. He would have put her in the cab.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, also too, that the coat, the sleeves were inside out, and I can see that visibly. If he's trying to pull her out, you know, pull her up to safety. And, I mean, her arm slipped out. Naturally, they would go inside out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I can clearly see that, right. I clearly see that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's very troubling. And there's another aspect of the coat that I could get into, and the hair as well. When the police were searching the property during the second search warrant, they found a burdock bush out behind the pool that had a couple of hairs stuck to it, and they took actually several close up photographs, and if you look at their own photographs, you can see two, maybe three hairs in that photograph. But what's interesting about that is that hair eventually got sent to the laboratory in the state police laboratory in Albany, and we have a copy of the laboratory examiner's notes and report, and she counted 18 hairs. So I don't know how two or three hairs that you can see in their photographs kind of multiplied into 18.
Why
very
concerning. Why do you think that the pathologist wasn't called to testify? What do you think that issue was about? Why wouldn't they? I mean, the forensic pathologist.
I don't know why he wasn't called the first time. I really don't. I wish I knew. Maybe we wouldn't be here today.
I mean, exactly. I mean, because you would think that he would be. That's the huge part of the trial. That's
it is
the
huge part.
I mean?
You got two experts who come
in. I'm amazed that the cause of death was just changed for no medical reason at all.
Right.
And we got somebody from the 201 that wants to chime in. Maybe they have a question or a comment. I'm going to bring them on just real quick, if you don't mind.
Sure.
From the 201, what do you have to say today?
How you doing? This is Peter's brother.
Oh,
can you?
Good to meet you, sir.
Yeah.
Hi,
nice,
sir.
How you doing? The reason why I'm calling in is because it seems like a lot of this situation is a cover-up. And the circumstance that she in the past had connections and she got out of 4 DWIs. So with this being said, you don't know who's on the up and up and you don't know who might have had a grudge against my brother. There's many avenues that have not been covered, and basically it seems like nothing makes sense of the situation. And the last time I was up there, I went across the street to take pictures of the property, and I actually wound up getting a recording of an individual, which if I'm allowed to, I'd like to play it on the radio, indicating the feelings towards my brother, because my brother was the type of person that would give the shirt off his back, and if you didn't like how he felt, he didn't care. And he would tell you how he feels and how he thinks, and he'd be honest with you up front. And a lot of people didn't like the way he would react to certain situations. And there's a lot of people that had issues with my brother because my brother was an honest person and didn't like drama and didn't like situations. And if you were an asshole, he'd tell you you were an asshole. And basically, my brother stood for what he believed in. And a lot of situations that took, but what a lot of people do not realize is at one point in time, I lived with my brother. And I look a lot like my brother. And my brother told me a while ago that a lot of people or somebody was saying that they would see my brother arguing with somebody that was a resemblance of blonde hair. And to tell you the truth, at one point in time, I lived up there with my brother, and I had a girlfriend with me that had blonde hair. And me and her had not such a great relationship, and there were times we were outside the house, and we'd be arguing. And people would probably think that was my brother arguing with Patty. So the misjudgment of that situation, I found out from my brother. Now, I have a recording that I'd like to play of an individual that purchased the property. His name is, I don't know if I'm allowed to say over the radio, but I'm going to play something. Hopefully you can hear it.
Yeah, okay.
Hold on. Can you hear that?
No, it's not coming across.
No.
Hold on. Hold on. Can you hear that?
Vaguely.
Hold on. Give me 1 second. I know what I need to do. Give me 1 second. I will hook it to the audio system in the car, therefore to amplify the speakers. Give me 1 second. Hopefully I can get this to work. Basically, I had seen somebody on the premises, and I had walked up to them questioning who they were, and basically, I didn't even know who they were. I'm having kind of a complication getting everything set up with my phone. Can you still hear me?
Yeah,
yes,
what we can do is give you time. We can give you time to get that set up and come back to you in just like a couple minutes or so. How about that?
Yes, please.
Okay, so all I'm right. going to just mute you just for a moment. I promise I'll be back on and bring you back on in just a few minutes or so.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so while we give him time to get that together, so in small towns like that, sometimes that's what you'll have. You'll have people, the whole town will turn against you. So that sounds pretty believable to me, what this gentleman is saying about his brother.
Right.
Okay, so he got convicted, and then there was a trial to see if he deserved a retrial. And how did that go?
No, it wasn't a trial. It was just the appeal,
which is a hearing.
Yeah, it's a decision made by the appellate division. It's just a panel of judges.
Okay.
And they decided that the issues outlined in the appeal were correct, and that he should be granted a new trial. Basically, what happened in the first trial, the appellate division ruled that evidence that was offered and admitted into evidence, offered by the district attorney and accepted by the judge, was inadmissible. And because of that, it denied him a fair trial, so they granted him a new trial.
Okay.
Basically what they did, I mean, I talked earlier about the police finding some diaries at the house Well, they tried introducing those at the trial, and they actually did introduce them, and but according to law, they're considered hearsay because you can't cross-examine what somebody wrote in a diary. So they should not have been allowed, and that's what the appellate division determined. So they granted him a new trial. But then the problem came in the second trial. The problem came now you've already got somebody on trial a second time who's been convicted once, and he's being retried in the same small community. So a change of venue certainly would have been appropriate, especially
yes.
in a small county like that. But it was the a request for change of venue was made, but it was denied. And so we had to deal with a pool of jurors that were already aware of what had happened before. So
right,
he was convicted
right.
again. So he was convicted a second time. And then
okay,
the second
so they
trial,
found
he,
him guilty the second time.
He was found guilty the second time. And then the second trial was.
Did he change his findings? Is this when Dr. Ed changed his findings? It went from a drowning to, well, at first he said it was a drowning, right?
Yeah, and then he changed it to, called it a homicide by suffocation.
Homicide by suffocation, okay.
And, you know, the defense put up a great defense, I thought, in the second trial, but he was convicted. Again, he appealed it again, and he won his appeal again. So he was granted a third trial.
Okay, I've got two questions.
Sure.
Question number one, was there ever a reason given for the denial of the change in venue?
No, it was just summarily denied.
Okay, that sounds.
And then same thing before the third trial. Change of venue was requested again, and it was still denied.
I don't see what the problem is with giving a change in venue if somebody requests it, especially you know you're in a small town like that. That's a perfectly reasonable request on an appeal, in my opinion.
Sure.
Okay, and what was the other thing I wanted to ask you? What did you say just a moment ago?
I'm not sure. I said a lot of things.
In which part?
I know. I had something else that was ringing my bell. I really wanted to ask you, and I had put the.
Well, until you, I know because you know you're a little under the weather, but that's okay. And so while you think of that, I want to ask you, and I know you're not at lib to say, but I really want to ask you. You said earlier that you have done some previous work for Peter. Can I ask you what that was?
No, I didn't do previous work for Peter. I had done some previous work for his attorney.
Okay, for his attorney. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I had worked for Randy Scharf was his second attorney in the second trial, and I had worked with Randy Scharf on a previous capital murder case in Broome County.
Okay.
So okay. that's how Mr. Scharf knew me, and that's why he got a hold of me when.
And he asked you to come on board. Okay.
Yes.
And I know Randy's out there waiting to come on. We haven't forgotten about you, Randy. We're going to bring you on in a few. I promised the gentleman I was going to bring him back on so he can play us that recording. But just to summarize everything. So far we've gone through, okay, he had a first case, he was convicted, they made a decision that on the appeal that he could have a second trial, and he was reconvicted, and then there was another appeal, correct?
Correct.
And what happened on this appeal?
On this appeal, it was, there was an issue with one of the jurors. It was a juror who was allowed to serve that probably shouldn't have, and the appellate division agreed, and that was, and then the other issue was I don't agree with it, but There was a piece of evidence that was allowed into evidence that that they said shouldn't have been, and it was offered by the defense attorney. So they determined that Peter's attorney was ineffective counsel, and I don't think it was a fair decision, but at least it granted him the appeal, and he won a third trial. He was granted a third trial, I should say.
He had a third trial?
He had a third trial in 2012, and again, in the same county, and he was convicted a third time.
So where is his case at right now? Does he have any more appeals left?
There's still one decision being considered. He lost his first appeal, but there's another one pending, and a decision hasn't been rendered yet. So that's where we're at there.
Okay. So let me, because we're going to have to get to a point to where we figure out exactly what we need to do, because we're getting short on time. And let me bring this gentleman back on, Peter's brother. Okay, sir, we're bringing you back on. Were you able to get that together?
Yeah, I did. And I just wanted to answer some things that I heard the other gentleman talking about with the suffocation. Here's what doesn't make sense, okay? Supposedly they said he suffocated her. And the thing is this, my brother was in the United States Army, and I was a prior military because I'm a veteran, and we were trained if somebody was injured to have to carry them, okay? And we were trained, you know, from 180 to 200-something pounds if a wounded soldier. Now, Patty weighed 90, maybe 115 pounds, 130 the most. So my brother was a very strong person, and he wouldn't need to be dragging anybody, because I overheard a long time ago that supposedly she had in her hair and she was drugged through bushes. The problem with her was that she had an alcoholic problem. And with an alcoholic, sometimes when you try to take away their alcohol, they'll turn around and they'll hide their alcohol in bushes and stuff like that, and just to try and get over on the person that's trying to stop them from becoming an alcoholic, worse than what they already are. So, you know, with that situation being said, you know.
So here's what I just remembered what my question was that I forgot. Okay, they say she was smothered. Smothered with what, and where was that evidence at? Where's the murder weapon?
Well, you cannot quote me because I don't know per se, because my father would know more and people that are more in depth. But what I can say is, to my recollection, supposedly they said that she was smothered with a pillow, and basically she was killed by that, and or she had bruising on her gut. Okay, so here's the situation. She had bruising on her gums, like if she was punched in the face. Okay, now given that situation, okay, my brother would not turn around and smother somebody in a house and then take her outside and drag her through burdocks or drag her through the ground when he's strong enough to pick up a grown man and she's light enough to be basically carried if that situation did occur. But what I will tell you is nothing makes sense.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. None of that makes sense, because if you're going to smother somebody in the house, you're not going to smother them outside, first of all. So you're going to smother them in the house. And then if you smother them, what are you going to take them outside and drag them around for in the bushes?
Now,
and
like I said, you can't quote me.
I get it.
I don't know the whole situation. But what I will say is this, with my brother's appeal, see, my brother is an innocent man, and some way, somehow, somebody knows somebody, and therefore, they're trying to pin it on my brother. Now, with my brother having three appeals, if they can take all his appeals, okay, and waste them, then my brother won't have a chance, because once you use up all your appeals, now you can't be heard, and
then
I feel
that's
been done to my brother.
That's That's it. Now, okay, now I'm going to – just 1 second,
I'm gonna
sir.
Try
I'm sorry.
This recording.
Okay, I'm going to let you play that. I'm trying to rush this along simply because we're getting short on time. But I do want to ask Dave if he can answer that question for me. Dave, what was the murder weapon, the suspected pillow? Was that ever brought into trial?
No, there was no pillow. It was their only theory was that Peter suffocated her with his hand. That he knocked her down into this burdock bush, even though there's no evidence of that, and then he just simply put the palm of his hand over her her mouth and suffocated her. That's their theory.
Now that doesn't make any sense to me because that's a huge struggle. There would be scratches all over his face. There would be all kind of stuff like that. It's very hard to just smother somebody with the palm of your hand over their face like that. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Okay, so with that said, sir, go ahead and play that recording real quick, and then we're going to bring Randy on.
All right, I'm going to try and get this to play, and tell me if you can hear it.
Okay.
You can hear it? Can you hear the brief background? I forgot about this. All right, you guys got it. Good question. You said that the last woman that got it.
Unfortunately, sir, it's not clear enough. But what I will do. Here's what.
Hold on. And you didn't see any burdock bushes or
nothing. All right, don't hold me to it. I'm sure there was a lot around. I don't know. I know what you're getting at. I know the whole story behind your brother.
Yeah.
I ain't going to help. I mean, why should I? The bush was overgrown. That's it. Right? That's it. The other thing is your father's a real asshole. Right? Well, definitely ain't going to help.
Why is my dad in that?
The problem with him, without him even introducing himself to me, right? He has the nerve of sitting over here with my son and my daughter, which I have every right to, please calling the cops on me. Right? So he's a total asshole. He didn't even come over and introduce himself. He wouldn't even wave to me and everything like that. But I want nothing to do with him. Just make sure he stays on that side of the street, not stay on this side of the street.
Okay.
Right?
Well, that's why I asked that.
Good. I'm glad. But as far as bird dogs, I know the whole story behind your brother. I ain't going to say yes, no, whatever. The place was overgrown, and that's all I've been doing is trying to clean it up. All right?
All right. Thank you, Dave.
All right.
Hello?
Wow.
Yeah, so who was that you were talking to?
That was the gentleman that turned around and bought the property. And as you can see, okay, there's a lot of hardship. So even though my brother is innocent, okay, what it is that there's a lot of dislike, and my brother's life is hanging in the pendulum because a lot of people have formed their opinion in a closed community, and basically they're holding a grudge match, or maybe they're saying things that they think they're doing the right thing, and really they know nothing about what they're talking about. If my brother was so guilty, why not let him go downstate to New York City where he's amongst other people that don't have preformed opinions, that don't know him, that don't know anybody, and aren't closely related or friends with anybody. Start with a fresh slate of people that know nobody, so nobody can hold a grudge, no one can tell a lie, and no one can do any harm to my brother by not being honest. Because the courts have held my brother up there, and for some reason, my brother has been trying to go downstate where he can get a fair trial. And for some reason, they're holding him there where he can't get somewhere else to be properly heard where there's no prejudice.
I feel your pain, man. That very passionate plea. And I agree with you 100%. 100%. What I want to do right now, sir, and thank you for your comments and everything. Please hang on. I'm going to go ahead and mute you out, not because I'm cutting you off, but because I want to go ahead and bring Randy on because I'm just so impressed with this lady. This is a lady who has no better reason than just a good heart. And she's been very patiently waiting to come on the air, but for no other reason than just a good heart, has decided to help this gentleman out. You know, just a perfect stranger. So I'm going to bring her on as soon as I can find the phone number here. Wait a minute, I found her. Here she is. Okay, Randy, are you there?
Hi, Dale.
Hey, thank
Hi,
you for
Randy.
Being patient.
Hi. Well, that's fine.
Thank
I
you.
Would rather the facts of this case be told, you know. I am Peter's advocate, but his story needs to be heard.
Yeah, but I think that it's important to recognize you and because I just want to ask you, how did you get involved with this case? And why?
I started getting involved in this case in 2012 after his trial. Prior to 2012, I was guilty, and, you know, just as everyone else did. I didn't, if you ask me why, I wouldn't have a reason why, because they say he's guilty. He was convicted, and that's it.
And that's
However,
the way we are as a people, right? We're human race.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get convicted by a court, and then everybody's like, okay, well, they're definitely guilty. They got convicted.
Right. Well, I also had his children in my preschool class. Peter's mother and father enrolled his youngest two children in my class when Peter went to jail. So, you know, this case kind of started hitting me in the heart then, and it's been here three times, so by the second time, I'm like thinking, you know, there's something really weird with this, you know, so the place that I worked at where I had Peter's children in my class, the director ended up on the second trial. She was a part of the jury, and I had told her that I thought he was guilty, and she's like, well, you don't know. You're not hearing the things that I'm hearing. And when the trial was over, she was quite upset because she had said guilty, but it was that whole aspect of what Dave was talking about with the diary piece. The jury didn't understand that the piece of evidence that they were looking at was a piece of a diary, but the investigator had made notes on it. And had they known that that was from the lead investigator writing notes, they would have said not guilty. But they didn't know, so and they thought it was Patty, so they said guilty. So fast forward to 2012, third trial, I'm sick of hearing about Peter Wolosik. And I know he's here, and I'm in the same county of where this happened, so I wrote to him and asked him questions, you know, rumors and stuff that I had heard. And we wrote back and forth a few times, and he answered my questions. And then I asked if I could go see him, and he said, sure. So I went with his father to see him, and I asked him more questions. And some words that I really appreciated him saying to me was, don't think I'm innocent because I say I'm innocent. Think I'm innocent because you look at everything and ask questions and sit through the third trial and then tell me what you think. So I met with Dave Beers, and I asked questions, and I sat at the trial, and then I formed an opinion. The amazing thing is I saw things that were not even allowed into the trial. So you don't always see everything at court. And I just thought he was innocent after that, and I just got on the internet and just started researching, and some people from the United Kingdom looked at stuff and thought he was innocent, and we just formed a group. That's pretty much it.
So the thing about it is, I said this at the beginning of the show, once you get locked up, that's it. It's like throwing away the key. People start forsaking you. Thank goodness his brother is still out here fighting for him. But if you don't have people out there who are willing to put in time and effort and who can believe in you, then you have no hope, right?
This is true, but I would also like to say, because many supporters thank me all the time for his case getting to where it is now, you know, people are starting to listen, and I have some good things going for Peter, but they constantly praise me. I don't want the praise because it's strength in numbers. It's people voicing this case, speaking for Peter, and without his supporters, he wouldn't be where he is case-wise now. I mean, he has a few good going for
him. Well, don't sell yourself short, Randy. What you're doing is a very godly thing. I understand where you're coming from. I appreciate your humility as well, which makes you even more godly. But what I'm trying to convince people of when I say this right now is that this man is alone, and he needs people, perfect strangers, to feel the way you do and come on board and try to help him. And so I'm trying to give our listeners some type of understanding of how that happens. So based on what you said, people who are out there listening, we need you to do the research, you know, not to just trust what you hear, you know, get interested and start researching the case yourself. You can start on the Change the World blog, www.thechangetheworldmovement.com. Thechangetheworldmovement.com. You can start there. It's unbiased. We offer both sides of the story, the prosecution side. We also offer the Peter side. And start researching through the evidence and paying attention to what has been going on and what is currently going on. And if you feel that this man is innocent, we need you to come on board and do whatever is in your power to help. Now, everybody doesn't have all day and all night to get involved in something, but the smallest thing that you can do can be helpful. Maybe it's to donate a couple dollars, $5, $10, whatever you can. Maybe it's to make a couple phone calls to your senator or the governor up there in New York, or maybe it's you contact or join Randy's Facebook page, Peter Wolosiewicz Case, on Facebook. Just look it up, Peter Wolosiewicz Case, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly or not. Excuse me if I'm not. But whatever it takes, I just want to plead with everybody, do the research, make your own decision, but if you find that you feel that this man is not guilty, he needs somebody to stand up for him. You can comment on the Change the World blog so we know how to contact you, or just leave your comments so that others can see it. We have sent out emails and letters and everything to movers and shakers within that community, inviting them to this radio show and this article on the Change the World blog so that everyone can see what the judges and the prosecutors and the witnesses involved in this case have done. And we need to hold everybody accountable. Okay, we need to hold them accountable. We need the news media to hold them accountable, and we need the public to hold these elected officials accountable, and just do whatever you can, okay? This show is archived. It'll be on the Change the World blog. It's on Blog Talk Radio. You can find it all over Facebook. Share this show across the World Wide Web. Send it to people who can make a difference, activists. Send it to judges, attorneys in that community. Send it to the mayor of that community so that everyone can hear this show and read that article and know with their own peers have done, you know, and so that they can begin to hold their peers accountable. That's all I have to say. Cheryl, what do you have to say?
Yes, you know, basically, I want to thank the guest today for coming on. And God bless each and everyone, even down to his brother. You know, this has to be a hard thing to go through, especially when you know that you're innocent. The main thing that I do want to say is basically to piggyback what you said, support. You know, we need support. He needs support. You know, it's really crushing that he has already been through 3 appeals. And I want to say that real quick because that's what the brother was touching on. He don't want to continue to exhaust these appeals. And I know that you guys are going to do the right thing. But everybody that's out there listening in Radio Land, you guys please try to support this case. I mean, it's a good cause, and I'm hoping everything comes out for the good for him. I really do.
Absolutely. And I'm trying to see. We got one more person. We've got about 30 seconds. I'm going to bring them on and see what they have to say from the 772. What do you have to say real quick?
I just want to say I support Peter wholeheartedly. He is innocent. We all know. The corrupt ones that did this to him know. My heart goes out to his family. Randy, I am behind you every step of the way. I will never give up until this man is free.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Join us every time we have a show. We're always trying to do something positive to make a difference. This is Let's Change the World. Thank you for tuning in. I see there are a lot of callers out there, and when there are a lot of callers, there are a lot of people on the worldwide web listening as well. Please share this show so that everybody can share in the enlightenment that we've received today about this case. And join us next show. We don't have a show every week. We have it every now and then because we always want to produce a quality product for our listeners, and it takes time to put these shows together. But be on the lookout on the Change the World blog, on Facebook, for our show. It's always going to be on a Sunday at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Peace, love, and togetherness, that's what we need. Take care. I'm going to leave you all with something that hopefully you all remember.
Family and the truth, you know, love is all we need.